Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Well, on a Sunday night, we often talk about psychology. We sometimes have our psychologist and philosopher look at issues from different sides of things. But given it's the Commonwealth Games at the moment, we thought it'd be really interesting to talk about the psychology of sport and championship, because we've seen this very much in cricket at the moment, which is less triumphant than the Commonwealth Games. Have a listen to this from this week.
I did everything I possibly could. I left no stone unturned to get out here and race for Australia in the 100 metre hurdles and the 4x1 metre relay. Everyone who is here today knows how much of a competitor I am, how much I love running for my country and for my teammates. And I know that I have a lot of fans, obviously, who are wanting to watch me race. But for me, it is about my health.
There's been some heartbreaking moments already at the Commonwealth Games, hasn't there? This is, of course, hurdler Sally Pearson withdrawing from the Commonwealth Games due to injury on Thursday. And she said later she was gutted and there are a lot of tears flowing, a lot of emotions. I guess you could call it grief, sort of going through the numb phase first and then going through the crying phase. And when you've focused on something all your life, you can grieve it for not, of course, achieving what you wanted to do. You can have grief for something that actually hasn't happened, I'm sure. So we thought we'd look at this tonight on the show. Martin Hagger is a professor in the School of Psychology at Curtin University in Western Australia, and he's in Brisbane at the moment at the Commonwealth Games. Hello, Martin. Thanks so much for chatting to me tonight on Nightlife.
Sure. Good evening.
How did you sort of feel when you heard Sally Pearson just talking about it as a form of grief, not being able to participate in the Games?
Yeah, those are the understandable emotional responses of an athlete when, like you say, they've committed so much time and so much effort towards what is essentially an extremely short period of time, you know, and to perform at the highest level. And, you know, athletes are often teetering on the brink between, peak performance and peak fitness and being injured, breaking down. And to be at the very top, you often compete on those fine lines, and you push yourself a little bit too hard, then you break down, and that can be extremely extremely emotionally effective, of course.
Yeah, and we saw, of course, the Australian walker who was disqualified, Claire Tallant, this week, and the sort of despair that she felt after that, and still managing to hug one of her teammates. And she, you know, they do train so hard for it, but then, of course, yeah, the body can let them down, or a mistake lets them down. It's just such high stakes for athletes. Do they need to be born with a particular psychological profile, or can they be really trained for that, to cope with this utter joy and despair and those huge feelings?
Yeah, it's a bit of both, I think. I think sport and performance at the top level naturally attracts a certain personality type. People who are very conscientious, people who are extremely driven, performance-orientated. You could call them type A personalities, very extrovert. In a lot of performance sports, those are the kinds of people who get attracted. But also, you know, sports psychology has become an extremely important part of the teams that surround professional athletes these days. And they are there to help athletes perform at their highest level psychologically, to prepare them for their event, and also to help them to cope with things that might go wrong, to cope with anxiety, to cope with the stress, to cope with any eventualities that were unforeseen or unexpected, those kinds of things. And often you'll find that sports teams have sports psychologists on their payroll as part of the teams, alongside trainers, coaches, physiologists, and managers, you know.
Yeah.
In addition to that, of course, you know, I think a lot of people view sports psychology, you know, it's for head cases. It's for people who have problems psychologically. But actually, that's not the case. You know, sports psychologists can be there to help people get better, to just improve. And athletes want to be absolutely at the top of their game all of the time because of the pressures of performing, you know, in a lot of different competitions. So sports psychologists can help people get better, you know, no matter what.
Yeah, so it must be a particularly rewarding form of psychology then if you're involved in it, because you're not always dealing with utter despair. A lot of the time you're feeling you're kind of helping people be better at who they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and psychologists have certain tools in their toolbox of techniques to help athletes to improve.
Give us an example of some of these.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of the time, athletes want to be in the right frame of mind before their event. And so a sports psychologist will work with the athlete on what they call a pre-performance routine. And so often you'll look at, if you look at some of the swimmers and they go about to go onto their starting blocks, if you look at athletes before they're about to line up for an event on the track, they'll go through a particular routine. And it's not the same for every athlete. But what they've done is generally they've worked by themselves with the psychologist to come up with a routine which helps them get them in the right frame of mind to focus on the kinds of things that they need to be focusing on and to shut out all other distractions. Mm.
They've often got headphones on now, so they're playing, you know, like kind of Queen, We Are the Champions or something, like a particular song in their head.
Yeah, absolutely, and that is one strategy that some people and athletes use. And you look at Michael Phelps; he's a classic example of that. He's always got his headphones on, and he has a very much a kind of shut everything out mentality.
Mm.
But then you look at other, and that works for him in terms of preparing himself for his events. But you look at other people, you know, classic Usain Bolt. He's very outgoing. He's using the crowd. He's interacting with other people. And that doesn't work for every athlete, but it works very much for him. And you suspect that if he didn't have that, he wouldn't perform quite as well. So it's different strokes for different folks. But the key thing is about getting the athlete in the right frame of mind at the right time and paying attention to the right things for their event.
Has anyone ever tried to quantify sort of the power of the psychology beyond the physical preparation and the talent that's there? Like, has anyone said, you know, like it contributes 20% towards success or something like that? I'm just wondering how big it is.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, it would be probably quite, because sport and all performances is quite, it's quite complex.
Yeah.
In terms of the different factors that go into it, it's difficult to sort of say, oh yeah, it contributes X percent to performance. But you know, if you look at the absolute top level of sport, and you consider that most athletes are pretty close in terms of their physiology, in terms of their training, in terms of their nutrition, all these kinds of preparation things, you know, a lot of the time it's the difference is. Mentality. It's the difference is how much do they want it? What's, you know, are they resilient to setbacks, you know, and minimizing mistakes and errors? All of those kinds of things contribute to victory, the difference between gold and silver, or silver and bronze, or between bronze and fourth. And so that's why athletes are beginning to recognize the power of psychology as an additional thing that they should be training for. You know, it's not, you know, athletes spend so much time preparing for their sport. They spend so much time on all of the different minutiae in terms of technique and fitness, all these kinds of things. But they don't realize, or they're only just coming around to the fact that they should be also training their mind.
Mm. You're on Nightlife. I'm chatting to Martin Hagger. He's a professor in the School of Psychology at Curtin University in Western Australia. He's at the Brisbane Commonwealth Games, of course, at the moment. Must be the place to be for him. And so you kind of, can you see things that are going on with the athletes while you watch them perform that you go up? Yep, I can see what they're doing there. I remember watching a gymnast before she got on the beam and she just said to herself, but her lips actually moved, so she must have muttered it. It was like, you got this.
Yes, so gorgeous.
It was like, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, that's right. And you know, often it comes down to that. And, you know, you look at, you know, some of the strategies that athletes will use are things like mantras, which are basically just words, which get them into the right frame of mind. And so, you know, often an athlete will say, like you say, you've got this, or focus. You know, and it brings an athlete's attention away from all of the other things that are going on around. And let's face it, you know, when you're in a stadium or you're in an arena, there's lots of different distractions. There's the crowd and so forth. And actually, you know, those things can make you can distract you from doing things that actually in training become very much automatic. And if you start overthinking the things that you should be doing, then that's when errors and mistakes happen.
Right.
So it's about, you know, blocking out all of those distractions and focusing on the task at hand.
Right. So you borrow from religion as well, because mantras, you know, kind of the Hindu or Buddhist sort of mantra that people will have is an assistant for meditation. It's a spiritual strength.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, you know, those kinds of techniques, those kinds of strategies, you know, things like meditation and relaxation techniques are actually very useful. You know, there is a sort of school of thought that, you know, there's an optimal level of anxiety at which, you know, athletes will attain peak performance.
Yeah.
And it's different for different athletes. So, you know, and you can see that. You know,
so you want to stress some out a bit more and keep others a bit calmer, because that their kind of point of where it helps them and hinders them is different.
Pretty much, yeah, absolutely. And actually those sort of mantras and those either calming words or relaxation techniques can help those who get too anxious to calm down and to get into the optimal state, whereas for others it might be a case of trying to gene themselves up and getting them so hyped up that they're ready.
You can see Usain Bolt doing that. So what about then if you've got a team? So say you've got, you know, like our fabulous netball team, the Diamonds, you've got different individuals with different psychological profiles in a team. How do you work with the team so they're individually powerful but also have that group psychology and dynamism going for them?
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of the time it's about, if you look at sort of the way teams prepare mentally prior to their performance, a lot of the time it's down to a culture within the team. It's down to a group norm, if you like. So what's accepted and what's not accepted? What are the kinds of things that we need to do together in order to get ourselves in the right frame of mind? Because often, you know, like you say, within the team you've got individuals, and those individuals, some of them might be more extrovert, some of them might be more introvert. But generally, particularly if you can build a team around a particular leader, who is, and that's why the team captain seems to be so important. They can develop, they can develop a culture of success and a culture of the kinds of things that they need to do to get themselves into the right frame of mind at the right time. So those are the kinds of things that teams need to do to get themselves into the optimal frame of mind before they go out on the court or on the pitch.
All right. In your TED talk, you talk about how underdogs can get up and win over champions, and champions can falter despite their really high confidence. So how does this happen?
Yeah, sometimes, particularly if the pressure's on, and if athletes are not prepared for that, it can be distracting. You can overthink the things that you do naturally, and that can lead to what psychologists call a choke.
Yeah.
You know, people get either they might be overconfident or they might get distracted, and so therefore they don't focus on the kinds of things that they need to. They don't focus on the cues or the prompts to do things in the right way. So they don't, for example, they can't read the game as well. They can't spot what the opposition is going to do next. And these are the kinds of things that they might do quite naturally.
So the ones without the big expectations, the underdogs.
Yeah, and those underdogs, you know, they may feel, they may have an attitude where they've got nothing to lose.
Mm.
They've got an attitude where this is our time to shine. They might have an attitude, and, you know, the athletes will work with their coach and with their team captains and with the team around them to say, well, you know what we're good at, but we've done our homework, and we know what the so-called, you know, the favorites, we know what they're not so good at, and that's where we know their weakness, and they can often exploit that.
Well, that's where the sledging happens in cricket, isn't it? It's sort of to psychologically well, distress the other team, and it's pretty hardcore and unsporty.
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, look, at the top level, you know, some athletes will do anything to win. And if as long as it's within the rules, you know, it's fair game. And a lot of athletes will try everything they can. But of course, that can push people over the edge. And, you know, we've seen recently in Australian cricket where, you know, that edge was, you know, they pushed it a little bit too far. And they pay for it, you know.
Yeah, you can be too competitive and focused on winning and at the expense of your own self and possibly your future. I mean, given that, do you think, say with some of the elite cricketers, we had Gideon Hay just saying some of them are man-children. Have they focused so much on cricket that they're underdeveloped as individuals psychologically? I mean, I don't want you to comment on the individual cases, but can that happen in sport? Have you seen that happen?
I suppose so. I think perhaps if you know, the sport, and I don't necessarily subscribe to that notion that there's almost, you're almost making an excuse for what they did because they're in some way, you know, immature or whatever. You know, I don't think that's the case. But I think if the sport is all consuming and if victory is so important, that they lose sight of some of the things that make sport, so important, and they lose sight of the rules, and they lose sight of fair play, then I think it's problematic. And I think that you know, that might have been part of what happened. Everything, you know, the stakes were so high, and perhaps, you know, they thought, you know, this was a way of getting an edge, this was a way of achieving, and this was a way of getting one up on the opposition. And of course, there was, you know, you've got to take into account context. There was a lot of antagonism between the two teams in this case. But actually that sort of pushed them to do that. And they thought they could get away with it.
Yeah.
So the level of scrutiny, it wasn't the case.
Yeah. So, Martin, I mean, given this, you know, given the kind of high psychological tactics going on, the kind of things they've learnt things like the Commonwealth Games, how can athletes get ready for life after they retire? How can psychology help here, not just to help them when they're in the profession or the, you know, the sport, but afterwards as well? Because I imagine coming off that high and coming off that podium and then going and having a normal life would be pretty hard come down.
Yeah, it is difficult. And there's, you know, there's a lot of cases where athletes really do struggle after, like you say, they dedicated their whole life to a sport and pursuing excellence in a particular arena, that when that goes away, actually there's a huge gulf, a huge empty space. And unless they've sort of thought ahead to try and think of, you know, what is next, what's around the corner, you know, some athletes can sort of go off the rails a little bit. And you've seen sort of some quite high-profile cases in which that has happened.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I think the onus is on the coach, the team around the athlete, managers, and yes, psychologists as well, to help the athlete, you know, at least think a little bit far ahead. Because, you know, being an athlete, unless you're very, very lucky, you know, your sporting career is going to last 10, 15 years if you're lucky. And so I think, you know, there's a whole lot of life to live after that. And I think, you know, the team around the athletes really do have to help the athletes think through that in order to try and identify some sort of career transition. And this is an area of research when people, you know, explore possible avenues that athletes can take beyond sport. And, you know, there are obvious ones, things like coaching, mentorship, those kinds of things. But they can also go into things like, you know, journalism, punditry, that kind of thing. So there are opportunities out there. It's a question of kind of nurturing the athletes into that space and getting to recognise that they do need that after the sport's over.
Yeah, and also what about the kind of the addiction to that adrenaline and that high? That must be hard to come down from too.
Yeah, I think so. And that's why you do actually see quite a lot of high-profile comebacks. You know, athletes retire from the sport. They think, you know, I've got something lined up. But you're right, they miss it. And they think, well, why not give it another shot? Because, you know, I'm young enough, I've probably got the talent, that kind of thing. Sometimes it comes off. Sometimes there are these amazing comebacks. Sometimes it doesn't. And actually, in some respects, some of the comebacks can be a little bit counterproductive. You know, it makes the sort of them miss the sport more and miss what it was more.
Mm.
So I think, you know, sometimes they can be ill-conceived.
Yeah, and that must be even harder to get over.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking to me tonight about this. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We've been chatting to Martin Hagger. He's a professor in the School of Psychology at Curtin University in Western Australia, and you can check out his TED Talk if you look it up online as well.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.